Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. It is not every day that I get the thrill of speaking with a writer of the stature of Buzz Bissinger, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer responsible for a whole host of great books, including most famously Friday Night Lights, which has just been republished in a special 25th anniversary edition. Mr. Bissinger and I spoke on a previous occasion about another book of his called LeBron's Dream Team, How Five Friends Made History, a very intriguing look at LeBron James very early in his life and the first basketball dynasty which he helped to build. I'm also very much admire a beautiful book Bissinger has written called Father's Day Across America with an Unusual Dad and His Extraordinary Son. And he has lots of other books to his credit, and maybe you've also read his outstanding writing in Vanity Fair magazine. Again, today we are focusing on the 25th anniversary edition of Friday Night Lights, which includes a very interesting new afterword in which Buzz Bissinger reconnects with some of the young men whom he profiled as part of his groundbreaking work from a quarter century ago. Buzz Bissinger, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm really happy to talk with you. I have to start out with a question that's a little strange, maybe. There are some ways in which your own relationship with this book, Friday Night Lights, has been kind of a turbulent one, starting with the way in which it was received in Odessa, Texas, by some of the folks there, and also the fact that it was this huge, phenomenally successful book. And so in some ways, your relationship to the book and its success is ambivalent. What does it feel like now to be pummeled with interview requests as this book is re-released? Are you frustrated to still be talking about Friday Night Lights, or is it still kind of a rich terrain for you to be talking about?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I mean, I've made peace with it. At a certain moment, frankly, it did really torture me because of the enormous success of the book that I did not anticipate. You know, I knew the goal was to not write about high school football, but to write about the way in which high school football influences every strand of small town life, whether it's parents living through their kids, or whether it's academics, or whether it's race, and whether they're heroic, or whether there's tragedy. But it just took off, and it sold very well, and then it becomes a film, and it sells even better, and then it's a television show. It sold about 2 million copies, which is insane. And I wrote this when I was 34 years old. This is my first book, and I realized in my mid-40s I was never going to top it. And I would say in my early and mid-50s, as my life was crashing around me, I hated hearing about it, so I didn't really watch the television show. It became kind of this noose around my neck, this feeling I'm a one-hit wonder. But, you know, things changed, and my life changed, and now, you know, I embrace it because it's hard to believe. 25 years later, people still, you know, want to talk about it.
That they do. And I do have to say, I actually read Friday Night Lights for the first time when this 25th anniversary edition came out. I'd certainly heard about it, but I wasn't particularly interested in kind of the general subject matter. And then over recent years, I've read and interviewed a number of authors who have written books that in some ways are roughly comparable, sometimes about following a football team for a year or a great baseball team or a couple of championship wrestlers. And I realized that it was my loss, having not read in some ways the seminal book that was probably a real inspiration for a lot of imitators that have come after it. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, about some of the other books that have been written in the wake of Friday Night Lights.
Well, I sometimes think that I started the growth industry. It wasn't that I was the first to do this, but I was maybe among the first or the first to really almost make this a sociological work and ethnography. As I say, I wasn't really interested in high school football as much as I was, the way it influences and continues to influence, you know, life in small town America. I think one of the reasons the book has done so well is because it's timeless. The issues raised then are arguably even worse now. And I know there have been a lot of imitators and there have been a lot of terrific books. But, you know, since I started it, I think I should get some of the royalties. I think it's only fair.
Absolutely. Maybe you could say a word about why Odessa, Texas, when you decided that you wanted to write a book about the hold that football, high school football, had in small town America. What drew you specifically to the relatively remote community of Odessa, Texas? Nothing like any place, I think, in which you had ever grown up or lived.
No, I mean, nothing close. You know, I grew up on the Upper West Side in New York City, which is about as far away as you can get from Odessa physically and certainly psychologically. I picked Odessa because I knew you had to do a book like this in Texas. I picked Odessa because it's not quintessentially a small town, but its remoteness makes it very isolated and finite in feeling. And I also picked it because I wanted a narrative, a story to tell, and the Permian team I wrote about at that point was the winningest team in Texas State history. So I hope that this would be a team that would, you know, advance far in the playoffs. And I should add, parenthetically, I actually wrote the book in Shorewood, Wisconsin.
Ah, really?
Yes, I did. My wife was a med student at the Medical College of Wisconsin. So after Odessa, we moved to Shorewood and wrote the book, and it really was most wonderful moments of my life.
Wow. Very glad to know that connection to Wisconsin. You actually say early in the book that this football team, the Permian High School football team in Odessa, Texas, was the most successful football dynasty in the country, pro, college, or high school. I mean, that is lavish praise you are heaping on this football program. What led you to characterize it in that way?
Well, you know, when you're talking about Texas high school and you're talking about winning state championships and you're talking at the highest level, it is ultra competitive. I mean, there's some great teams in Texas. And Permian's record in the 1980s, in the totality of the 1980s, I followed the team in 1988. In the totality of the 80s, I think they won 4 state championships. I think they went to the semifinals 5 or 6 times. They went to the quarterfinals 6 or 7 times. And that's astounding because you're not only playing in the regular season. I mean, you've got to run the table for, you know, 5 games. And the only thing, you know, obviously there were the great Packer dynasty in the early 60s and then the Steelers. But to have that kind of record, that kind of consistent record year in and year out was phenomenal. But the problem is that the expectations get raised to enormous and frankly, in some ways, crazy levels.
You don't say too much about this, and I'm very curious to know how your overture, in a sense, was received, particularly by the coaches of this high school team. The idea of a guy not only from out of town, but out of state, from a whole different part of the country, coming in and being there. And you were there not only for essentially the course of that entire year, but you describe it as though you were at essentially every practice and every meeting. I mean, you were always there. How open were these coaches to your presence in their midst, given the fact that they take what they do so incredibly seriously? Were you viewed at all with suspicion in the sense of perhaps being a potentially disruptive source in what they were doing, a disruptive presence? Or did they just willingly embrace this opportunity?
They did embrace the opportunity. And at that point, when I so-called pitched the book, I thought it would be much more of a Hoosiers type book. I had no idea what would happen in the 1988 season, some of which was very disturbing and very shocking and sadly still goes on today. As I said, I think that's why the book has endured. They were very open. And then you learn, you know, when you get the kind of access to every practice and every meeting, open or closed, and you're really with the team, you learn to shut up. I mean, you learn to kind of keep in the shadows. As the season unfolded, I saw shocking instances of racism. I saw totally misplaced academic priorities. I saw a high school football program that it just, in a sense, was both beautiful and talented, but also, you know, out of control in terms of its popularity, in terms of its importance. And I had to write about that. Now, did I discuss that with the coaches? Absolutely not. Did I warn them about, you know, you better lower the temperature? Absolutely not. When they really discourage kids from taking the SAT exam in the fall on Saturday because it conflicted with watching game tape of films? Absolutely not. And I like the coaches. They hated the book, and the head coach comes off extremely well in the book, and he doesn't like it, and I accept that. But he also hasn't read it, which is kind of odd. But, you know, I am a journalist, and they knew I was a journalist. And no, I did not play my hand. And there are Hoosiers-like elements. The games are beautiful. The kids are noble, noble gladiators, willing to sacrifice every possible ounce of themselves. When I went back to Odessa to do the afterward, I felt the same chills I felt then. But, you know, there were elements that no journalist could possibly ignore, and nor was anything exaggerated. People have had 25 years to discredit the book and have not, you know, not been able to.
It's all true. It's all true. Could you say a word about establishing comfortable, easy rapport with these young athletes? Because, again, you were in so many ways a fish out of water. I mean, out of your most comfortable element, I'm assuming. Although maybe you could say a word, too, about how, for instance, how familiar were you personally with the game of football? Had you played football? Or, I mean, in any other respects in your life, I mean, did you have common ground you could draw upon in order to really establish rapport with these young athletes? And going into it, were you worried about that?
Well, you always worry about that, and then you worry about the culture difference. I mean, here's a guy, you know, who's in a tweed jacket and penny loafers and is from the East Coast and has lived a life of embarrassing privilege coming into Odessa, Texas, which is primarily a tough, gritty oil town and working-class town. And I wonder, would the Gulf and Gap be too big? I played high school until my sophomore year in high school at 5'6" and 140 pounds. I wasn't tough enough, nor did I have much future, but was a huge sports fan growing up in New York City, season tickets to the Jets and the Giants. So I knew the game, and, you know, it didn't take – these kids were sophisticated in a sense. They had reporters around them all the time. Because Texas high school football was covered very, very closely. And if you become state champion, you're covered by every major newspaper in the state. So they were familiar with what a reporter was, and they said, you know, this guy's here, he's going to every practice, he's making a commitment. So I don't think they changed their feelings or changed what they did. And after a while, when you're there enough and you begin to meet the kids, they were curious about me, and I was curious about them, and then they pulled a horrible, wonderful prank on me, which frankly really broke the ice.
We're speaking with Buzz Bissinger, and we're talking about his book, Friday Night Lights, which has just been re-released in a special 25th anniversary edition. And I keep neglecting to include the subtitle of the book. The full title is Friday Night Lights, A Town, A Team, and A Dream. Let's talk for a moment about the town of Odessa, Texas, because I think one of the best things you do about this book, and the reason why it's such a fascinating book to read, even if somebody isn't completely enamored with the game of football itself, is it's just so fascinating to learn so much about a town that probably at a glance wouldn't seem all that interesting, and yet it's tremendously interesting when someone with your perceptiveness examines it and talks about it. I wonder if you could say a word about this matter of what you call the boom and bust cycle, which was the reality of Odessa, Texas over the course of decades, which, in your words, made for a unique kind of schizophrenia for Odessa and its citizens. What are you talking about there?
Well, you know, Odessa to me is there's a lot of things that are wonderful about it. There's some things that are not so wonderful, at least when I was there, and I think there have been significant changes. But it's an American place. You live by your wits. You live by your hands. It was in the Permian Basin, which is the biggest oil field, you know, in the country. And people who work in oil, you know, take risks. And as we've seen recently, oil price goes up, and then it goes down. And when the price goes up, the town expands, and the boom is on, and people build houses, and they're flush with money. And crime rate goes up, murder rate goes up, everything goes up. And then the bus comes, and, you know, there's vacant houses all over the place. And people have lost a lot of money. And the roughnecks who work in Odessa have now gone somewhere else. And so when I got there in 1988, it was in a bust period. So it does create for schizophrenia. And I think that's one of the reasons that high school football, you know, was so important. And certainly you can argue it was heightened in Odessa in the 1980s. But, you know, this is happening at thousands of American towns all over the country. The kind of small places that we sort of dismiss, you know, the places you see as a dot on a jet plane flying overhead. And I am convinced that every place, every town in America, there are fascinating aspects. And that was one of the things that I wanted to explore. Because and I appreciate you saying this, it's not a book about high school football. It's not. It's simply the glue and the narrative structure of the book. And one of the greatest gratifications is that, you know, women, as many women as men, have said, I love this book because of what you wrote about, the intensity, the pressure, the tragedy, the heroes, and the way mothers and fathers live vicariously through their kids.
Absolutely. That's a very, very human story. It's not really a football story at all. Another quick question about Odessa that I want to ask you about, because this is also, I think, a really interesting observation you make. You said it was still a place that seemed on the edge of the frontier, a paradoxical mix of the Old South and the Wild West. And again, that's not, I'm sure, unique to Odessa, Texas, but there's probably not all that many places in America where you might say that about it. An interesting mix of the Old South and the Wild West.
Well, I have to say, and this sounds awful, that was a really good sentence. I can't believe I wrote that. I mean, that sounds really good. Much better than I thought I actually write. It was Old South in the sense of segregation. The schools were not desegregated until 1982, and that's, what, 28 years after School Board versus Brown? I mean, that's very shocking. It was a town that was, you know, very much divided between black and white. The minorities, the blacks, lived on the bad side of town across the railroad tracks, and then the whites lived on the other side. And, you know, the use of the N-word, and I hate even mentioning it, was prevalent and shocking. The racism shown towards one of the players shocks me and disturbs me to this day. His name was Boobie Miles. But the frontier mentality was, you go for it. It was a place, you know, it was a scam in its founding. It was founded by a bunch of wheeler dealers from Ohio. And they promised, you know, bountiful water, great place to have a farm. And, you know, they got there, desert. And, you know, they really built the place by the grit of their souls and the grit of their hands. And there's a wonderful friendliness to it. It is the kind of place, still, you know, you keep your front door open because you never know who might need a place to stay. And that was very much the feel of the place. So there was this paradox, just like you point out, there was the schizophrenia between the, you know, boom and bust. And that makes for a very, very interesting place.
Before we talk about some of these athletes and a few of the specifics, I do want to jump ahead for a second. I think I mentioned earlier that this 25th anniversary edition of the book includes an afterword in which you share with us the experience of reconnecting with six of the most important young men in this book. And you reconnect with each of them in person. And it takes you at least down in and around Odessa, Texas itself. Could you just say a word about how different Odessa itself is now versus when you were there 25 years ago? And we should also maybe mention parenthetically that you say at some point that you've been back to Odessa actually quite a number of times since 1988. So you're in a position to really kind of chart whatever arc it has been on. Or is Odessa pretty much still the same place it was back in 1988?
Well, I have been back to Odessa frequently. We have dear, wonderful friends, some of the closest friends I have who live in Odessa. When the book came out in 1990, it was enormously controversial, particularly in the town of Odessa. I was supposed to do a book tour down there and had to cancel it because of threats of bodily harm. And I knew people in Odessa, and they would be willing to take a swing at me. I knew that because that's the way they are. They're open, they're honest, and they're blunt. But I have seen the town. I was most recently there in April. It's grown up. It's certainly bigger. It has a cosmopolitan feel in certain places. And I also should point out that high school football at Permian High School is not nearly what it was. The town has changed demographically. It's now majority Latino. And certainly, you know, what kids do on a Friday night, there was no cable really when I was there. There was no internet. There was no Facebook. But I think the town has diversified and really, you know, grown up in some very, very, you know, positive ways. But the nexus of high school football has now shifted. The new Permian probably is Allen, Texas, which has won 3 state championships and parenthetically built a high school football stadium that cost $30 million. Katy High School, which is outside of Houston, is building a 10,000-seat stadium. I think it's going to cost $58 million. So the themes of Friday Night Lights are, you know, disturbingly alive and well.
We're speaking with Bud Bissinger about the 25th anniversary edition of his classic Friday Night Lights, A Town, A Team, and A Dream. A couple questions I want to ask you about Permian High School, where this football dynasty existed. This is one of the few things, your book is just so thorough that there's hardly anything I was left really kind of wondering about. One of the few things I wondered about was, what was the place of other sports at Permian High School? I mean, clearly, none of them equaled the centrality of the football program. But obviously, there were other sports there. Baseball and basketball and wrestling get mentioned maybe a time or two. And you weren't really there to follow those programs. But I just wonder if you came away with much of a sense of if those programs mattered even remotely as much, and did the athletes approach those sports with anything like the same ferocious intensity with which they undertook the game of football?
Well, you know, kids in Texas, kids in Wisconsin, I mean, kids all over the country approach the sports that they play very, very seriously. So they have their own individual intensity. But other sports besides football, yeah, I mean, they were there. They were lip service. They got very little attendance. No one ever talked about them. And you talked about change in Odessa, Permian High School. They now have softball. They now have soccer. Soccer? When I was there, I don't think they knew what it was. Football was God, king, and country. They played in a stadium that in the 1985 cost almost $6 million and seated 19,000 people. And on many occasions, that place sold out. And that shows you the dominance of high school football, you know, in that town. So other sports were just really, you know, not important. They were there because you had to have them, basically.
And I know, I mean, like, for instance, the quarterback of the football team you followed, Mike Winchell, I know you mentioned at some point that he was also a very good baseball player. But right. By and large, did these football players engage in those other sports as well? Because some coaches are pretty possessive and would just assume their athletes weren't involved in other sports.
They allowed Mike to play baseball because he was very good. Mike, as you said, was the quarterback. They did not like it because you, at that point in time, you were allowed to have spring practices in football. They discouraged it. There were some players who ran track or threw the shot put, but by and large, you know, football was it. So out of a squad of what 55, there might be 5 or 6 people who were playing, you know, other sports. One of the factors that made Permian so good was the off-season workouts, and they would, you know, place garbage cans around the wrestling mat so kids could vomit and then go back to work. So it made for an incredibly well-conditioned team, so there was a storybook quality, because here's this team from the middle of nowhere in West Texas. Here's this team from a city that, you know, it's a bad city when even Texas makes fun of it. But here is this team in this town with a legendary football program that routinely beats bigger schools with bigger kids because they fight harder and they play harder and they compete harder. And they're more disciplined. And that's reflected in the book. There's something still very, very powerful and magical about the high school football experience. It's really our sense of priorities about it. And what happened then and what I know what happens now is academics are really considered an obstacle to get through in order to play football or sport. They're not considered the mainstay. Academics, you got to get through them, you got to pass, but once you're done with academics, you know, let's go play some football. And that's a dangerous sense of priorities, and Friday Night Lights was really the first to point it out in detail.
Right, and in some very, very interesting and disturbing detail. You've been asked hundreds of questions about Friday Night Lights over the years, and probably you've been asked 10 of the same questions hundreds of times over and over again. I'm wagering the question I'm about to ask you, you have not ever been asked before. In my other life, I am a college music professor, and one of my colleagues used to live in Beaumont, Texas, and he has described to me the enormous focus in most of the state of Texas on choral music. And at the high school level, for instance, there are all kinds of high schools where being in the choir is a supremely important activity. And Texas is just has this ravenous appetite for choral music. The state's Choral Directors Association sort of operates independently of the rest of the country because they have so much choral activity going on. And I knew nothing about that. It was a real education for me. I just wondered, did you ever encounter the choir at Permian High School in Odessa, Texas, or is Odessa one of those places where the choral music craze in Texas has failed to take hold?
Well, I have never been asked that question, and it's a hard question to answer. I have to say, and I don't doubt it, because Texas is just an ultra-competitive state. But at Permian High School, I didn't hear a lot of kids singing through the hallway. football was the king. But I will say this. The high school band was enormously rigorous, and the head of the band at that time was this marvelous figure. I forget his name, but he was tougher than the football coach. So the marching band was very, very important at Permian. But I didn't hear much in terms of choral singing.
One of the facets of this football team that really jumped out at me, besides when I love the phrase you use at one point early in the season when you said something about how the team was about to become the property of those so desperately devoted to it. And of course, that's so much of what this whole book is about. One facet of that desperate devotion to the football team played out in the form of a group known as the Pepettes.
Yes.
And these were young ladies in the high school. And it's just an extraordinary thing, although maybe something like it exists in other places. Tell our listeners about the Pepettes and what they were just expected to do and were happy to do on behalf of the football players.
Well, I don't know about other states. In Texas, I'm sure that the Pepettes did exist then. And I should say, in terms of change, the Pepettes are no longer, which I think is a really good thing, because one of the themes of the book is the institutionalized inferiority of women in high school, which is also something I think exists today. The Pepettes were a group of girls, and it was very prestigious. Each of them was assigned a football player, and their job was to make a big yard sign. They make these huge yard signs. Some of them look like mini Rose Bowl floats. They go in the front yard of a player so everyone knows that he plays for Permian. And then on Friday, I forget when the pep rally was, at the weekly pep rally, they would bring food, you know, cookie or cakes. One of the kids, I think, was brought a six-pack of beer. So they really are, you know, geisha girls, and, you know, whether sexual favors, I don't know. We can guess. But there was a geisha girl mentality, and there was the mentality of, you know, women are there to serve their man. And it was strange to see. It wasn't good for women, and it also puts these kids on yet another higher rung of a pedestal. And that's the problem we have and what we do with athletes. And the thing is, it's starting at a younger and younger age. It's now starting when they're 7 or 8 years old, and they get on that pedestal, and they're treated differently until something happens when they're knocked off. But as I say, fortunately, the Pepettes are gone. I don't think it was a good institution, and I give the high school credit for, you know, moving into the 20th century and realizing that it wasn't a good thing. But was it strange to see? Yeah, you know, in some ways, being Odessa was like being in a third world country. There were all these things that I had never seen, you know, in my life.
I could scarcely imagine.
Right.
Let's talk about the athletes that you got to know and befriend, and who we get to know very, very well through the course of this book. There are six of them in particular, and six that you specifically reconnected with as part of this 25th anniversary edition. I wonder, was it hard to sort of decide to focus on these six athletes? I mean, I'm not saying you went in with this idea that let me find six of the most interesting guys. I mean, I'm sure you had no idea at the outset just who was going to sort of emerge. That being said, was it hard to know, in a sense, who to write about and how thoroughly to profile certain guys, and also what facets of their lives to sort of bring to the fore? How tricky a matter was that for you as the author?
Well, it's a good question, because it was tricky. You know, that's the fear that you have going down. A, you don't know what's going to happen. If they go 5-5 for some reason, there goes your story. And B, are they going to talk to you? Are they going to relate to you? So in the beginning, you're quiet and you're observing. And, you know, when you observe, you see certain mannerisms and you see personalities emerge among the players. And then what I did was I took various players, you know, out to lunch where we could talk to see if they were, you know, amenable to me, profile them and be with them. And, you know, from there, it you know, kind of developed. I did write about the three captains because they were the senior captains. And I, you know, there's no question that the six kids I picked were kind of representative of what I saw as the entire team. The quarterback, Mike Winchell, who just the pressure on him is beyond belief. I mean, he shakes in the huddle because the expectations are so enormous. Don Billingsley, who's the bad boy. Boobie Miles, who's, you know, the great Black Hope. Brian Chavez, who's a genius and second in his class and sees football for what it should be as an outlet. Jared McDougal, who lives, breathes, and dies Permian football. So that was part of the selection process.
I was curious about Mike Winchell, the quarterback of the team. We mentioned earlier he was also a very good baseball player, someone who did not like crowds, I mean, and in some respects a really tortured young man, and we feel for him, feeling such enormous pressure upon his young shoulders. I wanted to ask you about something you said about Mike Winchell. That is, this is actually at this point when he was about his incredible play in Little League Baseball. You write, he became the stuff of legend with 27 pitches in a row thrown for strikes, a single season in which he hit 30 home runs. And then somewhere around the time his father started slipping, I should mention that's a health issue that his father had, which ultimately claimed his life, Mike lost that innate confidence in himself. The gift was always there, but he began to question it, doubt it, brood over it. I'm just curious, for a young athlete like Mike Winchell, did he tell you that, or did someone else tell you that, or did you manage to sort of figure that out or ferret that out? Because again, we're talking about young men who might not necessarily be actually all that emotionally demonstrative, or maybe even all that self-reflective. I'm just curious, in an instant like that, how did you come to understand that about this particular young man, Mike Winchell?
You know, I mean, you know, going back, and I'm trying to remember, Mike said some of it. His brother, who I interviewed at length, said a lot of it. And since he was his brother, I felt that was a credible source. And you could see it. I mean, you could see him brood. You could see him shake. You know, you could see him just unable to shake off a bad pass. And the coaches talked about it as well, that Mike had an incredible gift, but could he really, you know, embrace that gift and know how good he was? And so that's why you're there. I mean, I lived there for a year with my family. You know, you can't do this where you parachute in and out every weekend. You have to live there. You have to breathe the team. You have to be there for every practice. You have to breathe the town, so that when you go back to Wisconsin to write, you're writing with knowledge and authority, and you can make those statements about someone and know that those statements are correct, because I pride myself on being a thorough journalist. But you can only do that you know, by immersing yourself in the life and soul and spirit of that team and that town.
Hmm. He in particular really comes to life for us. And again, I think we, as we read about him, we really feel for him and the weight of responsibility on him. One of the most gifted of the athletes on this team was a young man named Ivory Christian. And one of the things that is especially intriguing about him is his own kind of love-hate relationship with football. And it's an interesting story in the midst of what otherwise is the story of so many people who seem to love nothing in their lives nearly as much as they love football. And this young man, Ivory Christian, he doesn't have that relationship to football really at all.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, and I think one of the reasons this book has endured for 25 years, and I've thought about it a lot, is that it is timeless, and it's timeless because of these characters. I think that we all probably know a Winchell or someone like Winchell or someone like Ivory Christian, who's very ambivalent of the game. One of the chapters is the ambivalence of Ivory. Ivory was very, very proud. He saw the racism in the town. He saw aspects of not racism on the team, but, you know, he was very aware of the fact that there, in a sense, was some segregation on the team in terms of the black players, you know, hanging together. And so I think that bothered him. It bothered him a lot when he was incredibly skilled and did not start at middle linebacker his junior year. The person who took his place as a starter was 136 pounds. I mean, there was no comparison, and that bothered him, and that made him wonder why. And Ivory was very smart and very intuitive and very, very proud. So there were moments, you know, where he would get into the mania of Mojo, which was the moniker, and then moments where he stood back. Because, you know, when you live on the south side of town, you're not really a part of that. You know, you're not really a part of it. Sometimes you get invited to the parties. You know, sometimes you don't, because this very much was a sport that was embraced, you know, by the whites in the town. I mean, you know, the football team was overwhelmingly majority white, and there were six black players who took up, I think, seven starting positions, but they were always, you know, always on the fringe, and Ivory was aware of that.
Of course, the other black player among the six that you focused on was Booby Miles. And, of course, his story in some respects is kind of the central tragedy of the story because of the terrible injury which he sustained. And what made it especially tragic, of course, were the circumstances under which this serious knee injury occurred.
Well, Booby is a tragedy. I've kept up with Booby since the book. I love Booby. We've kept up regularly in the new afterword, which is a real afterword. It's about 10,000 words, and I spent time writing it. Booby is now in prison. I can't say I'm surprised. His life has never, ever been the same. He was one of the best running backs in the state of Texas. His physique was really almost like LeBron in football. He was a man among boys. And he had waited for his senior season all his life, all these expectations. The town has incredible expectations for him. And then I'll never forget it. It was in Jones Stadium in Lubbock, Texas. It was in August. It was just about dusk. And his cleat gets stuck in the turf, and someone hits him, not even that hard. And he tore his anterior cruciate ligament. And that pretty much was it. And then once he got hurt, he got discarded. There were horrible racial epithets said of him. And, you know, there are 1,000 boobies out there who get, you know, thrown by the side of the road when someone is better or when they get hurt. And, you know, it's dangerous for these kids. It's not a good thing. And there are thousands of kids like Booby who Booby was basically, you know, treated as, I hate to say this, but it's true, as a football animal, that the only thing he could do in life was play football. That's the only skill he had. So there were no academics. There was no push on him to study. You know, it was not encouraged. They just wanted to make sure he got through and would be eligible to play. And he will be the first to tell you that he really, really suffered because of that. When you're a 17-year-old kid and you're on top of the world, as a lot of these high school athletes are in this country, when you're on top of the world and people are extolling you and you have, you know, 10 or 15 1,000. I heard of some kid who plays, I think, for Allen, who had 30,000 followers on Twitter. 30,000 in high school. In high school. When that happens, you're not going to care about grades. You're not going to care about academics. You're waiting for that next football game. Booby as a junior got paid to play football. He would go into the locker room every Monday, and there would be an envelope containing as many dollars as yards he had gained the previous Friday night. Well, you're not going to care about academics when you're getting, one game he gained 300 yards. $300 to a kid who doesn't have a lot of money, that's a big deal, but it's going to blow your head. It just is. And, you know, he is the end result, and I think if there's anything in Friday Night Lights that lingers, although I think there's a lot that lingers, Booby is the ultimate cautionary tale of everything that's wrong about our system of sports today.
Hmm. Among the other important athletes whom you examine, one of the most interesting stories is of Don Billingsley, who's one of the real party animals on the team.
Right.
But beneath that surface is a really compelling story about he and his dad. At one point you say when his parents split up and he ultimately made the choice of coming back to live with his dad on a permanent basis. And you write, living with his dad, living with Charlie, was sometimes more like living with an older brother or a roommate than with a father. I mean, so that's the backdrop under which he is playing out his life the way you describe.
And that came from Don, and I met Charlie, and I like Charlie. And I want to add that Charlie was portrayed by Tim McGraw himself. And that portrayal was completely made up, basically. There was very little truth in it. Charlie had been an All-State player from Permian. Charlie was tough as nails. Charlie, you know, had issues, but you're right. I mean, Don wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. They were very big footsteps because everyone in that town remembers the great high school players. And so Don went to live with Charlie and played football. And Don inherited from Charlie, you know, Charlie liked the party, and Don loved the party. He was a rogue. He was a rogue. He was charming. He was funny. He was bright. He liked to drink. I remember him saying once after they lost the game, he said, you know, this is a great opportunity to find a woman who feels sorry for you, maybe go to bed. I mean, that's how he saw life. But, Don literally got religion after a dear friend of his committed suicide when he was a freshman in college, and that woke him up, and Don has gone on to do really terrific things. Is a healthcare consultant, looks great, still at his playing weight, has three terrific kids, which proves to me that sometimes the worst barometer of future performance is high school. I never would have expected that out of Don. Ever.
Right. Another, in a sense, surprise is, or somebody who very much discards some of the stereotypes that we've been talking about, is this a young man named Brian Chavez, who, unlike most of his teammates, was not only a very good football player, but actually a brilliant scholar as well, ranking towards the very top of his class, although one realizes that's not quite the accomplishment that it might be in a more rigorous school district. But nevertheless, you write, he fit every stereotype of the dumb jock, all of which went to show how absolutely meaningless stereotypes can be. He was a remarkable kid from a remarkable family. He would be one of the more feel-good stories in Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to feel good about Brian. And once again, he is a character that many people today can identify with your kids who love football. And by the way, I love football. But Brian saw football the way it should be seen. It's not a means to an end. It's a place to have fun, to get out your aggressions, to be part of what was then a legendary program. But he never saw it as a launching point. He was very, very strong. The way he talked sometimes, if you met him initially, say, well, what's with that kid? He doesn't seem very smart. And then you would get to know him. And then you would know that he was number two in his class, and then you would know that he applied to Harvard, and then you know that he got into Harvard. It was a very difficult transition, but he made it through, which was really wonderful. I think he was the first person to go to Harvard from Odessa in probably 25 years. But, you know, why did they pick Brian? Because, as I say, I was looking for types that were representative, not just of the team in Odessa, but the team everywhere in the U.S., basically. And as I said, Brian understood and saw football the right way. So what does that mean? If you keep perspective about sports, you get a lot out of it. That the things we always say you learn, but you don't learn because there's so much emphasis on winning, you do learn, particularly if you're academically inclined, which is teamwork, camaraderie, dedication, learning how to win, you know, dreams coming true. And Brian really personified that until, frankly, something happened about 5 years ago that just totally devastated me.
Right. And that's an interesting story, too, from your afterword. Finally, Jared McDougal, someone you felt so close to. And I have to say, there is a photograph of him in the book. I first saw this when the afterword was excerpted in Sports Illustrated, and I saw this photograph. And that was the moment when I thought, I finally have to read Friday Night Lights. Describe to our listeners this extraordinary photograph that I'm talking about and what it says about Jared McDougal.
You know, and I want to say that the pictures were taken by Rob Clark, and they are absolutely brilliant pictures, some of the best pictures I've ever seen, including the iconic cover. And this picture you're describing, Permian had just lost the Midland League. Midland was the sister city. It was a shocking loss. It was an upset. They had lost by a point. And there's a picture afterwards of Jared. His shoulder pads are off. He's just in his gray undershirt. He's sobbing. His eyes are closed. Another player is sobbing into his shoulder, and he punches his fist against the wall. And you're exactly right. You see the agony. You see the sadness. You see the pressure. You see everything in that face. You see a young man who has been absolutely devastated by, you know, a football loss, and you both feel terrible for him. And then you say, whoa, wait a second. Let's get a grip here. Could it possibly be that important? Well, the answer is yes.
In Odessa, Texas, it is.
Right.
That's for sure. Well, in this book, we get to know this remarkable town, this remarkable football program, and some of the remarkable young men who experienced this extraordinary glory, and then all of them, in one way or another, find themselves very much off that pedestal and contending with what the rest of life throws at them. And again, this new anniversary edition includes an afterword in which Buzz Bissinger reconnects in person with six of these major figures in this classic book. Again, it is the 25th anniversary edition of Friday Night Lights, A Town, A Team, and A Dream, which is now available in paperback from Da Capo Press. Buzz Bissinger, I thank you for writing this tremendously interesting book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. What a pleasure to reconnect with you.
Well, thank you. My pleasure as well.
Coming up on both Monday and Tuesday of the morning show, we're looking back 10 years at Hurricane Katrina, as have, of course, a number of different news outfits. I think you'll enjoy the interviews which I have culled from the morning show archives, including one with author Christopher Cooper called Disaster, which very specifically examines the mechanics by which FEMA so miserably failed in the moment that it was most needed in the wake of that disaster. We'll also be rehearing an interview with a journalist in New Orleans at the time who wrote so interestingly about how difficult it was to do the work of journalism in New Orleans in the midst of such a catastrophe. And we'll hear from the director of an outstanding documentary called Witness Katrina. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast is for partly to mostly cloudy skies today, relatively warm with a 40% chance of rain. That is upgraded from 20%, which was the forecast as of yesterday. And today's high, 77 degrees. Tonight, cloudy skies with a 70% chance of rain, especially late, with a low of 65 degrees. And tomorrow, Saturday, a cloudy day as well.